Thank you for listening to this message from Northwest Hills Community Church in Corvallis, Oregon. You can learn more about our church at nwhills.com. Today, Pastor Josh Karstensen is continuing a series on John, where Jesus famously feeds the 5,000, but he offers us more than bread and fish. Jesus offers us himself, which is the real bread that we need in a wilderness of hunger and longing. Are you seeking Jesus just to fulfill something that you want, or are you seeking him for who he truly is? After the message, you're invited to answer some application questions, which you can find on our website right under the worship service video. Now, here's today's teaching.
This is good. I just wanted to welcome all of our church family who is online. I want to say just real quick to those of you who are online, obviously a number of you are online because this it makes sense for you in this season of life and where we are with pandemic and so and such. But I just also wanted to gently, kindly say, if you can be here, you should be here. I know just as summer is getting here and warmer weather and so and such, it can be convenient and easy to just log in on a Tuesday, but the word church literally means to assemble, and so it is what we are called to do, to gather together. And again, I fully recognize a lot of people, it's not a good idea at the moment, but for those who can, the invitation is to join the party. So that wasn't on my notes, but I just felt like I had to say that. And I will probably give a solid sermon about the importance of gathering pretty soon here. I feel like it's necessary. But welcome to church. A few years ago, I realized that every couple years I go through different seasons in my life. And one of the seasons that I often go through every few years is a season of nostalgia. Right, where I go back and I love looking at old pictures. How many of you love looking at old pictures? Okay, how many of you hate looking at old pictures? Okay, my wife is one of those. There's a few of you in there. This started for me a couple weeks ago, or I guess months ago, when we had our Valentine's Day thing here, and we were supposed to find pictures of us. And so I pulled out the old hard drive, and my wife and I were looking at old pictures all the way back to when I first got my very first digital camera in 2003. And so we looked through thousands of pictures, and I find it really fun. My wife really doesn't like it at all, but I think it's really fun kind of going through looking at all these old pictures. And then it made me think, like, oh man, I want to look at some older pictures. And so I pulled out the one photo album that I have left. I have one, right? I threw away a ton of them when I got married, but I have one left from high school. And so that was kind of fun looking through old pictures. And then it led me to want to open up my yearbook. I don't know. I'm actually curious. Are yearbooks still a thing? Yes. Okay. I know you all have like digital ones that you carry with you everywhere you go, just perpetual ongoing. But when I was young, we used to actually take pictures, put them in a book, and publish them once a year when you were in high school. And I got one yearbook my senior year. And so a few weeks ago, just spent, I don't know, an hour, hour and a half kind of going through my yearbook. And I think it's a ton of fun. Mostly, yeah, I'm looking at pictures, but I love reading the comments every few years. And so I'm reading all these comments that friends wrote in here, and I find myself just laughing. Like, surprisingly, a lot of the things are actually pretty meaningful that people write, that high school students write. You're like, man, that's actually significant. I actually feel like, man, there's some substance there. And but something happened this time that hadn't happened in times past. As I was reading, I was certainly laughing and having a good time, and then I'm like halfway through, and my mind starts going like, oh no, like, I have kids who can now read. And I'm thinking through just all the implications of what is going to happen when my kid reads all this, and they don't have any of the context for all these relationships. And you're wondering, what in the world is written in here? Don't worry about that. There's all kinds of things, though, that the reality is, like, there's context to these types of things. And someone makes a comment, and you have a context because of your relationship with them. You know, I had a lot of friends who are not Christians at all and knew that I was a Christian. And we had, like, friendly banter back and forth. So I've got a number of people writing in their things because they know that this would really bug you. I'm going to say this about you just because that is the nature of being a Christian in a non-Christian world. And so I just thought, man, it's really interesting how if you don't have context to how people know you, it can be really hard to kind of get the whole picture of someone if you're reading something, right? And you think about scripture, you think about how we have all the different stories about Jesus, and you think about the gospel, and the gospel is written in such a way, the gospels, the four of them, they're written from four different perspectives of different people who know Jesus from different parts of his life. And I think, man, it's really interesting how different writers know Jesus differently. When I was thinking about my yearbook and how someone who writes in it, you know, there may be someone who's known me for 15 years who wrote in my yearbook. There may be someone who I met in one class for 15 minutes who wrote in my yearbook. But as we think about the Gospels, as we think about who's writing about Jesus, what's interesting about John is John, this is the best friend who's writing. You know, this is someone who knows Jesus likely better than anyone else. He says something at the very end of his book, almost as if, you know, when a really close friend writes in your yearbook and they say, "Where do I even begin?" Right? Or they say something like, "Words cannot even capture, you know, our relationship." But then they have to say something. And John says this at the very end of his letter. The last thing that he says, it's literally the last sentence. In John 21, verse 25, he says, "Now there are also many other things that Jesus did. Were every one of them to be written, I suppose that the world itself could not contain the books that would be written." Man, we get the sense that as John is writing, he knows Jesus like no one else knows him. But what's interesting, too, is as we study John, we see things in John that no one else writes. We see that Jesus, the relationship with John, we see John's all about capturing the heart of Jesus. He's all about saying, hey, here's kind of the story behind the story. You get to kind of Mark and Matthew, and they'll share the story. But with John, he often gives the story behind the story, and I love that about John. And that's what we're going to see today in John chapter 6. Right, in John 6, we're going to get to the most famous of all miracles in the Bible. This is a story that if you grew up in church, I guarantee you've heard this before. It's the only story in the entire Bible that is written by Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, other than the crucifixion. But it's the only miracle that is written by all four gospel writers. But what John does is he expands upon this story. And so today is going to be kind of a two-part, or this week and next week will be a two-part series or sermon, if you will, because you kind of have to get them both. But John goes through and he looks at Jesus and he sees both the beauty of what happens in John 6, but also the tragedy of what's going to happen in John 6. And so my hope today is pretty simple. As we're going to look at a passage that is probably familiar to many, I really hope that by the end, what we're doing is we are literally just sitting at the feet of the cross, looking to Jesus saying, "I know you better now because of what I learned through John 6. You know, oftentimes we try to get as much application as we can, and we try to talk about, okay, now because of this, we need to do this in our lives. And this week, we're not going to do as much as that. I'm just trying to give us a clear picture of who Jesus is. I think the better picture that we can get of who the real Jesus is, the more compelled we will be to give our lives to him. And so today, I really just want to kind of get a very, very clear picture of Jesus' heart for you and me. And so to do that, we're going to start in John 6, verse 1. So I'm going to ask that we'd stand. I'm going to read the first whole, 15 verses here in John 6. And our hope is to see the heart of Jesus. After I'm done reading, I'm going to say, "This is the word of the Lord," and you're going to say, "Thanks be to God." All right, here we go. "After this, Jesus went away to the other side of the Sea of Galilee, which is the Sea of Tiberias, and a large crowd was following him because they saw the signs that he was doing on the sick. Jesus went up on the mountain, and there he sat down with his disciples. Now the Passover, the feast of the Jews, was at hand. Lifting up his eyes then, and seeing that a large crowd was coming toward him, Jesus said to Philip, 'Where are we to buy bread so that these people may eat?' He said this to test him, for he himself knew what he would do. Philip answered him, 200 denarii worth of bread would not be enough for each of them to get a little. One of his disciples, Andrew, Simon Peter's brother, said to him, 'There is a boy here who has 5 barley loaves and 2 fish, but what are they for so many?' Jesus said, 'Have the people sit down.' Now there was much grass in the place, so the men sat down, about 5,000 in number. Jesus then took the loaves, and when he had given thanks, he distributed them to those who were seated, so also the fish, as much as they wanted. And when they had eaten their fill, He told his disciples, gather up the leftover fragments that nothing may be lost. So they gathered them up and filled 12 baskets with fragments from the 5 barley loaves left by those who had eaten. When the people saw the sign that he had done, they said, this is indeed the prophet who is to come into the world. Perceiving then that they were about to come and take him by force to make him king, Jesus withdrew again to the mountain by himself. This is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God. You can take a seat. To get this whole story, we actually have to look at the other Gospels because there's a major gap in what has happened so far in the book of John in the story of Jesus' life. So if we were to go from John chapter 5, what we've been studying, all the way to this, there's actually about 6 months that happened, and there's all kinds of things that the other gospel writers write about in between. But if you read John, he just goes right through, and it's 6 months later. But if you're reading it, you just wouldn't know that that happened. And so we go back to where we were starting in Easter and kind of what Jesus does when he heals this man, and it's a major turning point in Jesus' life. Right, you remember so far in Jesus' life, he's doing all kinds of great things. He's turning water into wine. He's healing people, and everyone's kind of getting excited. The general populace is like, okay, who is this guy? You're doing things that no one else can do, and there's a real buzz about Jesus. There's an excitement about Jesus. But then on Easter, we learn that Jesus does something that kind of makes everyone pretty upset. Right, he goes to the pool of Bethesda and he sees this cripple there and he says, do you want to be healed? And this guy, he says, well, I don't have a way of getting in the pool. And Jesus says, I don't need your ways. I've got my ways. I am God. He heals him. He says, stand up, take up your mat and walk. And we learn that when he says, take up your mat, and when he does this on the Sabbath, he is breaking all the rules of the religious people and they get very, very upset. You're not allowed to do this on the Sabbath. You're not allowed to heal anyone on the Sabbath. You're not allowed to carry your mat on the Sabbath, which again for us is very confusing because you'd like to think that someone who's doing something great would be celebrated, but they get very angry at him. If you were to continue this story, we learned that right after this, Jesus gives his 5 arguments for why people should believe in him. I am God, and here's why. But then he continues on, and all 3 other gospel writers write about this. He continues on with his kind of provoking of their rules. He does 2 more things immediately following this that have to do with the Sabbath. The first one is he's walking through a field with his disciples and they're hungry. And he says, hey, pick up all the grain you want and eat it. We can do that. We're allowed to because I am the Lord of the Sabbath. And then we get another interaction on the Sabbath where Jesus, we read this in Matthew chapter 9. I love this. He goes into the synagogue and we read this in verse 10. It says, and a man was there with a withered hand. And they asked him, is it lawful to heal on the Sabbath so that they might accuse him? He said to them, which one of you who has a sheep, if it falls into a pit on the Sabbath, will not take hold of it and lift it out? Of how much more value is a man than a sheep? So it is lawful to do good on the Sabbath. Then he said to the man, stretch out your hand. And the man stretched it out, and it was restored, healthy like the other. This is shocking, it's frustrating, it's confusing. But the Pharisees went out and conspired against him, how to destroy him. Like, wait a second. Jesus is doing nothing but good things, but he's breaking the rules that they have. And as it says in verse 14, but the Pharisees went out and conspired against him, how to destroy him. Even Jesus gives a great argument. He said, you know, this argument of the sheep, like that makes a lot of sense. You could read that and the logic inside of you should go, oh yeah, like I would do that. And so Jesus does it and they still get upset with him. And so the hatred for Jesus just builds and builds and builds. If I had time, we'd kind of walk through this 6-month time period to see this religious hatred of Jesus. But I don't have time to kind of walk through the whole thing, but I'm just going to paint some really broad pictures here, some broad strokes to get us to the point where he is right before the feeding of the 5,000, because he is in a very interesting space during this most popular miracle that he's done. So again, rejection is becoming more and more common for him. Ultimately, he loses his hometown. He doesn't have a place to live anymore. So imagine, you know, you have a house, you have a place, you have a neighborhood, you have a community. Jesus had that, but at one point, he is run out of his hometown because people don't believe that he is who he says he is. So he doesn't have a place to live anymore. And so he's traveling around kind of place to place, a bit of a nomad, if you will. This is kind of the spot where he says that the Son of Man has no place to lay his head because he literally doesn't. Also, right before this, literally the event that happens right before the feeding of the 5,000 is his cousin, John the Baptist, is killed. And so we see that Jesus is in a deep place of hurting. He's experienced a lot of loss. He's mourning. And we read this in a couple of different gospel writers that he's trying to get to a desolate place to be by himself, to grieve. So he's just heard the news. John is dead, and he's saying, hey, let me go figure this out. Let me go mourn. This is someone who I deeply loved. I'm trying to get my life back together because I'm really hurting right now. And we read this in Matthew chapter 14, verse 13. It says, now when Jesus heard this, he withdrew from there in a boat to a desolate place by himself. In transitioning to our verse for today, but when the crowds heard it, this is immediately following, they followed him on foot from the towns. When he went ashore, he saw a great crowd, and he had compassion on them, and he healed their sick. The way that Mark writes it is he says this. He says, now many saw them going and recognized them, and they ran there on foot from all the towns and got there ahead of them. When he went ashore, he saw a great crowd, and he had compassion on them because they were like sheep without a shepherd, and he began to teach them many things. So you're getting this picture. This is the last 6 months. Rejection, rejection, rejection. People are trying to kill him at this point. The religious leaders are very angry at him. He's kicked out of his hometown. They go to a different area because some of the disciples are from this town. And he's heard this news that John had been killed. And so he's like, okay, let's just go out to the mountains for a little bit where we can be by ourselves and just regroup, regather, where we can mourn. And he's literally on a boat trying to escape, and people see him on the boat, and the town starts coming out to him. So he's literally going to the river, to the lake, and the town is following along the shore saying, yeah, that's Jesus. He can heal. I hope he can heal me. Let's follow him. And Jesus puts aside his own desire to mourn, and he says, these people are like a sheep without a shepherd. It says he has deep compassion on them. He pulls over the boat and he begins this time with them that we see where he feeds what is called the 5,000, but ultimately is something like 20,000 people. John sets up the scene. In verse 2, he says a large crowd followed him. Again, he's on this boat because they saw the signs that he was doing on the sick. So Jesus went up on the mountain. And there he sat down with his disciples. Now, this is crucial, verse 4. No other gospel writer says this. John's saying something different than all the other gospel writers through this as he's sharing the heart of Jesus. He says, now the Passover, the feast of the Jews, was at hand. This is incredibly important to realize. So this is happening during Passover. Passover is so important. It's this annual festival. It's this annual party. It's this annual celebration where they remember the freeing of captivity from Egypt, right? So they're remembering back to something that happened thousands of years ago, and they're saying, God, you redeemed us back then. You set us free back then, and we want to be redeemed again moving forward. We're waiting for this liberator. We're waiting for someone to come, and that hope and that anticipation was heightened during the time of Passover. It'd be like Christmas right now. Right? There's never a time in the year like Christmas where we're just like, thank you, Jesus, for coming, and man, we want you to come again. Right? So it's during that season, it's during that week that Passover is happening that everyone's saying, hey, Jesus, like, I think you might be this liberator. I think you might be the one to come. You're doing all these signs. Are you going to be the one who's going to free us from the Romans? So they have a very strict agenda that they have for Jesus. We're going to see this very clearly as this story concludes, but they have a very strict agenda. Kind of first practical application question for us is, do we have agendas for Jesus? Right? I think we all do to some degree. We all think about like, okay, Jesus, you are amazing, and you are often amazing in the things that you can do for me. Right? You're amazing in the fact that you can help me with my health, or you can help me with my job place, or you can help me in my relationships, or you can help me with my insecurities, or you can help me with my pride. I think very often we can think through Jesus through the lens of what can you do for me? And this is exactly what the people were doing when during the middle of Passover, they were seeing Jesus saying, okay, we're waiting for something and we think that you can help bring us what we're waiting for. Man, and Jesus does do some of those things for us, but those are half-truths, and we're going to look at the whole of that in a bit here. But we go back to the scene at the mountain, and Jesus, he knows he's been healing all day. Some of the other gospel writers say he's literally been healing all those who were sick. So he's doing all this healing. I think it's interesting John doesn't even mention that, because again, John has something bigger to share here. He's been healing all day. It's getting late into the day. And Jesus knows, hey, everyone's got to eat. But there's a ton of people here. There's some 20,000 people when you're counting everyone. And there's obviously nowhere to get food. But Jesus knows this, and he says this in verse 5. He says, where are we to buy food so that these people may eat? In verse 6, it says, he said this to test them, for he himself knew what he would do. And he asked Philip. Philip's from the area. He was a local here. So he said, hey, you're from this area. Where can we get all this food? And Philip replies, he says, there's no way we could get enough food for everyone. Then someone says in verse 9, this is Philip, or Andrew says, he says, there's a boy here who has 5 barley loaves and 2 fish, but what are they for so many? Ultimately, most people will talk about the fact that this boy eating barley loaves, this boy who had 2 fish, first of all, it's not like this kid's got a couple of salmon, right? He doesn't have this epic fish. It's not like he has this really nice meal. Barley would have been the poorest of all the poor grains, so this would have been a very poor boy. This would have been, think of like an anchovy, think of a sardine. So this is a kid who's got a couple of crackers, maybe a couple of slices of bread, and a very small little lunch. And the other gospel writers make it clear that there is no food anywhere else, nothing to be found. And yet this boy is willing to give up his lunch. Now, over the years, I've heard, 10 sermons about this. And one of the things that people will talk about is the reality of us offering what little we have so that God can use it for his kingdom. And there is some epic application that I think it's really important. But I think John's doing something a little bit bigger here. But I do want to talk just briefly about that, because I do think that there is something to remember through this. So God does use our limited resources, right? He uses them. He absolutely does. He uses them to bless us. He uses our limited resources to bless others, and he uses our limited resources to impact the world. Because think about this for a minute. Does Jesus need this man's lunch? No, of course he doesn't need this little boy's lunch. He doesn't need, if Jesus is able to take 5 slices of bread and 2 little sardines and feed 20,000 people, he doesn't actually need that to begin with. Right? He can call out bread from heaven. It could just appear. He could do that. But who gets blessed in the giving of his minimal resources, and for us hearing throughout the world what happens when we give what little we have? I think the first person that we see that's very obvious is this little boy, right? Because who is never, ever going to forget this miracle, right? This little boy. Because think about this. You're the guy who gives Jesus your Lunchable and he feeds 20,000 people. You're going to be like, I was there. Like, it was my lunch. I gave Jesus a high five. I haven't washed my hands since. It's amazing. He signed my sandal. I love it. Like, that story, that story was told for generations. Like, my great, great, great grandfather, he was the one. He had the thing. Jesus did it. Like, you know that happened. When we are faithful with little, God is faithful in return, right? We know that. And we know that very often the return of our little investments, we know that often it's just the joy of seeing God work through what little resources we have. So when we partner with someone like a Paul Berg, when we partner with a church and we give and we get to see, man, the gospel is going out to all kinds of different people. We just get deep joy in knowing that. And occasionally we do get God kind of smiling on us saying, hey, let me show you very tangibly that I am actually in control here, and let me smile on you. Because you know who ate more than he brought that day? I guarantee you that little boy was eating like 10 loaves and 15 fish. You know that he was. Right? Occasionally, I love it when God does that. Right? Last year, kind of about this time, I was driving to California. I was driving by myself. My family was already down there. And so I was driving, and I was about a half hour from Grants Pass. And it was an area where it was kind of mountainy. The rain's pouring. It's really heavy rain. And I see a car that's flipped over on the side of the road and kind of smoke's steaming up. And I pull over. It seems to be a theme the last couple years of my life, like a lot of car accidents. But so I pull over, and there's a woman standing in the rain, and there's another car. One other car had pulled over. And so I jump out and kind of like, hey, what's going on? And so there's this woman here. She doesn't speak hardly any English at all. And there's another couple in a car that's trying to help her, but this couple obviously didn't want to be there. They're very uncomfortable. I guarantee you they were pot growers. They had a couple pit bulls in the back, and they're like, hey, we called the cops, so we got to go. And so like they take off immediately. This is Southern Oregon, right? It's just par for the course. So they're leaving, and I'm from Northern California. That was not a dig on anyone. Wow. Just saying. So here I am, it's pouring rain. I'm like, okay, we got to figure out how to like give shelter to this poor woman. And so I'm like going back to my car, trying to clear out space, but I got a tiny car and there's not much room. So I go, okay, I got to find you a jacket. And I found my favorite jacket was kind of on top of all my clothes, and I didn't really want to give her my favorite jacket. So I'm looking for another jacket and I couldn't find one. Okay, I grabbed my favorite jacket. I'm like, okay, here, put my jacket on. And we tried to communicate a little bit, but it didn't really work. And so eventually the cop comes. And he gets my information, and I leave, and she tries to give me my jacket back. I'm like, no, it's pouring rain. You need it. And so I leave, and I'm driving, and you know, I'm like happy. Yes, I was able to help this woman. It feels good. But I mean, if I'm being super honest, like there was a part of me that was like, oh gosh, that feels costly. That was my favorite jacket. I've had that for like 20 years, and I'm a jacket guy. I love jackets. It's a lot of memories, and this is a great Carhartt jacket, a lot of use, and no one wants a new Carhartt jacket. The old one, you know, it looks good. Like, man, it's been used. And so literally, I kid you not, 5 minutes goes by. My mom calls me, and this is not completely unusual, but she says, hey, I'm going to send you some money. I want you to buy something nice for you. And so I kind of smile. I'm like, okay, God, like, you're awesome. So a couple weeks later, I'm actually with Pastor Gary, our youth pastor, and we were going up to Portland for something. I go to the Carhartt store, which I never would have gone to unless I gave this jacket away. So I go to the Carhartt store, and I'm looking at jackets. And of course, the one I want, hey, is like the most expensive one in the whole store. It's kind of frustrating. It's like, oh, okay, but I want this one. So I start talking to the sales associate there, and this is a woman who just moved to the area, and she just starts telling me her story. I mean, it's just coming out. And so I'm like praying for her in the store, in the Carhartt store, as she is just sobbing and just life's coming out, and I'm praying for her. And I'm just smiling, going like, God, like, you knew you wanted me here. Like, I know that you wanted me here. And so I'm about to go pay for this thing. And she comes up. She goes, hey, I want to give you the friends and family discount. So I get this jacket for half off as I'm walking out of here. And it just made me smile because it was the exact same dollar amount that I paid for this other one 20 years ago. And it was just so much better. And all that to say, God just sometimes says, hey, would you just trust me and be obedient and give away even the things that you really like? And I will take care of you. I promise I will. And you don't always get the new jacket. But occasionally you do, and when you do, I think it's fun when God just says, hey, I got you. Man, is God asking you to be generous in any area of your life? Think about the little boy. How easy would it have been for him to say, hey, you know what? Like, I've got a family back home. I wasn't even planning to eat this myself because I'm hungry, but I got a little sister. I got a mom and dad. Like, how easy would it be for him to say, well, I'm a little boy, and there's a lot of, like, full-time professors out here, and they've got way more resources. Like, they're teaching in Capernaum. Like, they know what they're doing. Or there's, like, professional fishermen. They certainly have more resources than I do. Like, how easy would it? Or, like, Jesus, you're God, apparently. I saw you heal this person. You don't really need my lunch. Like, you can create resources. But here's this little boy. Hey, Jesus, here's what I got. I'm going to watch you work. And Jesus does. He takes that, and we read this prayer that he gives. He lifts his eyes up to heaven. We're going to see his heart here. He blesses this, and most people believe this would have been kind of an ancient Hebrew prayer before meals. And the prayer sounds like this. It says, blessed be thou, Yahweh, our God, our King of the world, who causes bread to come forth from the earth. And he breaks it and he gives it out to everyone. And there's 12 baskets left over. I love this, just the abundance of who Jesus is. And in verse 14, we're really going to see Jesus' heart here. So when the people saw the sign that had been done, they said, this is indeed the prophet who is to come into the world. Perceiving then that they were about to come and take him by force to make him king, Jesus withdrew again to the mountain by himself. So here's Jesus before this, and he's discouraged, he's hurting, he's mourning, his cousin has just died, and he sees all these people like sheep without a shepherd. He has compassion on them, and he's got a heart for them, and he's doing for them what they need, and they miss it. They completely miss it. And Jesus is incredibly discouraged. He's incredibly sad, and he leaves. He sneaks away, and he goes back to the mountain. It's like they've missed it. They missed the whole point of what I did. They don't get it. So what did they miss? And we go all the way back, and it's just, it's amazing how these stories just so are parallel to each other. You go all the way back to the Exodus. And when God's people were freed from Egypt, when they were wandering the Arabian Peninsula, trying to kill time, essentially, to get to the Promised Land. But right after they get out, they're hungry, they're starving, they don't have the food that they think that they need. They cry out to God, and listen to this in Exodus chapter 15, starting in verse 2. And the whole congregation of the people of Israel grumbled against Moses and Aaron in the wilderness. And the people of Israel said to them, "What that we had died by the hand of the Lord in the land of Egypt when we sat by the meat pots and ate bread to the full. For you have brought us out into this wilderness to kill this whole assembly with hunger." Verse 4, then the Lord said to Moses, "Behold, I am about to rain bread from heaven for you, and the people shall go out and gather a day's portion every day. Listen carefully, that I may test them, whether they will walk in my law or not. On the sixth day, when they prepared what they bring in, it will be twice as much as they gather daily." So Moses and Aaron said to all the people of Israel, "At evening you shall know that it was the Lord who brought you out of the land of slavery. And in the morning you shall see the glory of the Lord, because he has heard your grumbling against the Lord." Notice what it doesn't say. It doesn't say the people needed food and God gave them food. It doesn't say that. It doesn't say, hey, they needed food, so God gave them backpacks, and in each of these backpacks, they had 500 protein bars with a 10-year shelf life, and everyone was good to go. That's not what God does. He knows that they're hungry, and what does he do? He gives them daily, every single day, and it's so clear. We don't get a clear picture than Exodus 16. "So that every evening you will know that I'm God, so that every morning you will see my glory." And he does this to test them, to see if they will walk in his law or not. I want you to trust me. I want you to walk with me. I want you to know me. I am here not just to give you what your stomach wants. I'm here to give you what your soul needs. See, when Jesus is breaking the bread with everyone, we know throughout the story of the entire Bible, like, breaking bread is always a symbol of relationship. It always is. It's an intimate setting. It still is to this day. When you want to have a relationship with someone, you have a meal with them, right? This is what you do when you're dating. This is why you don't do it with someone who's not your spouse, right? It's intimate. And Jesus, like, relationally, it's always a thing. And Jesus, he's breaking bread and he's saying, hey, I want to be in relationship with you. I want you to know me. I want to know you. And they don't get it. They don't get it. They're like, okay, perfect. You're the guy who can do what we want you to do. We want to make you the king. And Jesus just says, you don't get it. He knows that he can feed this crowd. He knows that he can give them what they want. But he also knows that tomorrow is going to come and they're going to be hungry again. He knows that they need something greater. He knows that they need forgiveness of sin. He knows that they need wholeness. He knows that they need completeness. He knows that they need meaning and purpose, and they need eternal life. They need bread that never runs out. They need him. They need that relationship with him. But they miss it. They miss it all. Are you getting the heart of Jesus? This heart of Jesus that in the most famous of all miracles, he's actually coming in. It's not necessarily the highlight of all highlights. It's not this like really happy, like, wow, look at the power of Jesus. I think sometimes we can look at this miracle and look at the power of Jesus, and that's good. He is very powerful. But I think more than anything, we see the heart of Jesus. He's like, I'm breaking bread with you. I want you to know me. I want you to know me for who I really am. And who I really am is someone who deeply wants you to trust me and to follow me and know that I am God, not someone who just is some magic genie in your own box who gives you what you want. Jesus has a heart for you and I that is so much bigger than the tiny box that we put him in. Man, as we wrap it up, We've been talking every single week the last couple weeks about the boxes that we put Jesus in. Our little mini theme for a little bit is rise, like rising from these lies that we believe. These people believe this lie that said, Jesus, you exist to meet my needs. And the needs that they thought that they had were immediate, right here, right now, today, food. And then ultimately that he would free them from Rome. But Jesus has something so much bigger than our small expectations. I'm just going to say it again, and it may sound so repetitive. We all have ideas of what we think Jesus can and can't do in our lives and what he can and can't do in the world. But I want us to keep asking, Jesus, what lie do I need to break? Because you're bigger. Your box is bigger. You are bigger. You have something greater. And if they missed it back then, certainly the temptation is for me to miss it now. Jesus, what are you calling me to rise from? Father God, I thank you that we got to see a little bit more of your heart this morning. Lord, your heart that is for us, that is for relationship with us, your heart that says, I deeply want to know you. Jesus, I thank you that you're not just for our immediate needs. Yes, you meet those needs very often, but you're for something so much greater. Jesus, you didn't even care about feeding the people in that moment as much as you cared about showing them who you are, your nature, your power, your being, and just this longing to be in relationship with all them. Jesus, if there's areas in our lives that we are putting you in a box in, I just pray that we would eliminate that and that we would see you for who you are. Jesus, we love you, and it's in your beautiful name we pray. Amen.
Thanks for listening to today's teaching from Northwest Hills Community Church. We hope you find ways to apply the gospel to your life, and be sure to check out our website, nwhills.com, where you'll find ways to engage, including resources like our application questions. Thanks again for listening.